Welcome to the Open House Melbourne Catalyst podcast series. Open House Melbourne acknowledges the Wurundjeri Woiwurrung people of the Kulin Nation as the traditional owners of the land on which this podcast was recorded. This podcast series explores themes or issues that act as catalysts for creative design thinking and clever design solutions. Each episode features a designer or creative in conversation with a client or field expert to unpack the topic through the lens of design and the built environment. This podcast was made possible with support from the Alastair Swain Foundation. Find out more at alastairswainfoundation.org. I'm your host, Tanya Davidge, and in this episode, we're looking at critters as catalysts for design and engineering. When we think about design and architecture, we typically think about designing for people. But what does it take to design for animals? What does it take to get a frog in the mood for romance? How do you move pregnant elephants safely and securely from A to B? And how can design help to rehabilitate raptors? Today, we are speaking with engineer Peter Standen from Partridge and architect Stuart Harrison from Harrison & White to discuss how engineering and design can help to take care of our more than human friends. Peter, you're an engineer. Can you tell us about the type of work your engineering firm Partridge typically does?
Oh, how long have you got? We do a whole range of things. We consider ourselves to be a bit of a bespoke or a boutique engineering practice, focusing on smaller or more niche projects with an emphasis on design and pushing the boundaries on unique structures. So we do a lot of housing. We also get involved in art and sculpture and the zoo pieces. That's all. Anything and everything that's not cookie cutter or volume or large, I suppose we could put it that way.
Fantastic. And so you mainly focus on residential. How much of that work is part of your practice?
At least 55 to 60% of our work is single dwelling residential. We do a little bit of multi-residential if it's got a strong degree of design merit. Otherwise, we do commercial, a little bit of commercial structures, unique cables, meshes. We design in stone, aluminium, glass, bronze, brass, everything. It's a whole lot of fun. All the materials, and the more unusual they are, the more interesting they are.
Great. And I think we'll get onto the more unusual aspects of your practice a little bit later. But I'd like to also bring Stuart into the conversation. Stuart, can you tell us about the work that you do?
Yeah, so at my practice, Harrison & White, we're a general practice, but we have developed a few specialties, I guess, over the years. One is in the zoology space and this ever-growing world of non-humans, which is of strong interest. We also work, like a lot of architectural practices, in housing and education and little bits of commercial and community work as well. So we do a diversity of projects. Every project is sort of different and increasingly odd often.
Wonderful. So you've both worked on some rather unusual projects for Zoos Victoria. How do you get into designing for animals? What kind of resume do you need? And maybe we'll ask Peter first about that and talk about the more unusual aspects of Partridge's practice.
I guess you've got to have a bit of a track record, and we've been around for 42 years. The first unusual one, I believe, we did the Mad Max Thunderdome for the film set. And that allowed us to get involved into more of unusual set design and one-off pieces, which ultimately led us into doing the engineering on the Sydney Olympic Games opening and closing ceremony performance structures, which led on to doing some others for the Asian Games and some Winter Olympic rings over in Vancouver. And by being open to these unusual or one-off events where you're managing risk and approaching things from a first principles approach, the zoo work kind of folds into that quite nicely, because what load do you design a structure to support an elephant or a gorilla, for example? That's kind of the path and the journey which I suppose got us to that space.
And here you are now.
And here we are now.
So you did some, you started off by doing some work for Taronga Zoo then and have moved into doing work for Zoos Victoria?
Yes, we've done a number of enclosures up for Taronga Zoo. We also did most of the work for the Sydney Zoo when that was constructed 4 or 5 years ago. And yes, since we've opened up our practice in Melbourne back in 2019, we've been able, fortunate and lucky enough to do a number of projects with the Melbourne Zoo and one with Stuart up in Healesville Sanctuary. And we're in the process of doing one with Werribee.
Oh, fantastic.
Well, yes, a mix between Melbourne and Werribee, transporting the elephant herd from Melbourne Zoo down to Werribee.
Oh, wow. How many elephants?
I believe there's 9.
Oh, that's a lot of elephants.
It's a lot of live load.
Absolutely. And Stuart, how did Harrison and White get into designing for zoos?
Well, like most specialties, by accident. I mean, it is great to hear Peter talk about that interest in the temporary structures. And I guess you sort of come to these things, you do one, and you get interested in that area. And so for us, we were working in the education space, like a lot of architects in Victoria in recent years, working on state government schools. And we're working on a high school project at Lilydale High School. And so we were brought into that project based on our experience in education, not in zoology. But that particular school had a reptile house and a zoology facility, quite unusual for a high school. And that was an existing facility, wasn't fit for purpose. So part of the master plan and eventual projects that we delivered, stage one, was a new purpose-built zoology facility. So suddenly we were dealing with snakes and frogs for the first time, and this was fascinating work for us. It was fascinating work for the engineers we were working with and our other consultants. And you sort of lean on the expertise in that case within the school. They had a reptile specialist working at the school and a volunteer specialist who's ex-University of Melbourne. And so we were able to sort of speed up on all things zoology through that process and the complex climatic requirements that are needed, and able to then brief and work with our services engineers in that case. And then I guess architecturally and structurally provide facility that's genuinely sort of flexible, that can work as a kind of zoology facility, but also it's a general purpose teaching facility. So the zoology building at Lilydale High School and the Yarra Valley is how we got into it. And then that gave us a bit of experience in that space. And it was actually through Partridge, through Peter's firm, that we worked together on a facility out at Healesville Sanctuary. Partridge were doing the engineering on a frog breeding facility at Parkville at the time, and we were looking to, zoos were looking to do a similar facility, actually a mirrored facility, redundancy facility out at Healesville Sanctuary. And so we were looking at the documents for that facility at Parkville. And we saw this name, Partridge, and we thought, well, here's a firm. We should probably just work with them again because they've done one. And this was back in the sort of early part of the decade. And so Partridge were relatively new to Victoria. And so it was a great opportunity to work with what actually turned to be a kind of storied and well-known Sydney-based firm, going back to Harry Partridge, and a firm, as Peter's indicated, with a true history of innovation. So it was a great pleasure. So we brought Partridge on board to work on the frog facility, frog breeding facility at Healesville Sanctuary, and then a facility that was built immediately adjacent to that for the mountain pygmy possum. So we worked together on that project. And since then, we've worked on a couple of other projects in the zoology space.
And Peter, what are the engineering challenges when you design for frogs?
Frogs in particular, not a huge lot because they just kind of, they're quite happy sitting in tanks. But it's always a privilege to find out and open your mind to different things going on in the world. And learning about this project, you go to a project briefing and you're walking around the zoo and you go and you see the insect facility and the logistics that go behind just feeding the frogs. You've got to have a whole facility to breed the insects and the locusts and whatever else to then feed the frogs. And they've got all of these activities around that you don't see on the face of the zoo as a patron. And getting the story behind the animals and you see the zoologist's passion for the animals and the in-depth knowledge they have is really eye-opening and engaging. Frogs became endangered as a result of the 2000 1920. COVID's ruined my timeline.
Well, it got swamped in COVID. Part of that seismic event in animal protection, the bushfires of 2019-20, because the pandemic was immediately after that, that sort of got lost a bit in the sort of media landscape. But that was a seismic event in animal protection and extinction because it was devastating. And then we sort of forgot about it because then we were in trouble, the humans. But the non-humans were in real trouble out of that. And so the facilities that we worked on immediately afterwards for frogs, both the one at Parkville that Peter did and the one we did with Peter at Healesville and for mountain pygmy possums were directly related to those bushfires of 1920 because these were species that were facing very real possibilities, like high possibility of extinction. And to Peter's point, there were compounding effects as well. So the mountain pygmy possum, for example, very small little critter, it eats the bogon moth. That was also facing extinction. Mm. So you had a compounding effect. So the Healesville Sanctuary, for example, invented a cookie that the mountain pygmy possum could eat so that it began to replace the food chain. So it had to, it's just when you think about these as ecologies, you realize these things are all interrelated. We talk about design being interrelated, but this is genuinely interrelated things. So what we're facing was a collapse in species potentially. And so Zoos Victoria, and you know, one of my takeaways from working with zoos is they're an extinction prevention organization now, primarily. I mean, they're about taking your kids and zoos and all that sort of stuff and that tradition of exhibition. But their role now is essentially around preventing things from becoming extinct.
Wow. And what conditions do you need to successfully breed frogs?
Well, this is where the fascinating part comes in and the engineering aspect. We now don't say engineering from a structural point of view, but how do you create an environment that's conducive to frog lovemaking? And it turns out that the researchers, they went out into the creeks and collected tadpoles, and then through time they became frogs, and they discovered that these frogs would only mate in certain conditions which were typical of during or after a storm event. So the frog breeding platform or breeding facility is effectively a climate-controlled, insulated room that allows them to control the temperature and the humidity that these frogs are experiencing in their habitat, of which they've been able to mimic from nature. And they can raise the heat and the humidity and then artificially create a storm event. They get strobe lighting and mist and create the effect of a storm, and then, bam, stop that and raise the temperature again, and then that gets the frogs all amorous and has been a wildly successful breeding program. And I believe it's one of the first or something like that that the in the southern hemisphere in the world around how to successfully breed this type of frog, which is a testament to the zoo, but it's a fascinating.
Yeah, to add to that, the frogs we were dealing with at the sanctuary, there were three breeds of frogs, the burrowing frog and a couple of others. And yeah, Peter's right. The challenges are really environmental and climactic more than they are architecturally or structurally. The buildings themselves are pretty simple. They are about creating an envelope, a sealed envelope, sort of basically lab-like sealed environments. But the innovation really is actually in the mechanical systems to try and be able to vary the temperature. And so one of those frogs, it breeds in a very cold conditions. So sort of the opposite of humans, I guess. And so you've got to kind of – you're simulating these environments. And it is about simulation. And in some ways, simulation has always been central to zoology. But from an exhibition point of view, you're trying to try like a microcosm of their environment, both kind of environmentally and aesthetically. In the breeding space, it's really – very much focused on the climatic conditions. And as Peter alluded to before, the facility itself is really just a series of tanks in relation to frogs. And then once they're established, then they can go into more, I guess, typically natural environments and return to their environments of origin. Because often these frogs have been brought here to either Parkville or Healesville to have this breeding program. And it has been, Peter's right, it's been successful. But yeah, the challenge is really kind of environmental more than architecturally and structurally. The frog facility, both at Parkville and Healesville, had an overroof structure to help deal with the temperature variations and keep sun off to sort of reduce the heating and cooling load on the building. So it's kind of a double structure that was used. And so that has an interesting enough structural and architectural implication. But these are back-of-house buildings, particularly at Healesville. There's only a small percentage of the Healesville Sanctuary site is actually publicly accessible. There's a whole big back-of-house area, which the public doesn't see, where a lot of this breeding is going on. At Parkville, which is a more compressed site, a Melbourne Zoo, you can actually see the frog facility there. It is not publicly accessible. There's a little bit of public sort of visibility into it. It's a bit more public, but it's essentially the same idea. It's sort of a series of boxes with essentially a big canopy roof over the top of it.
Fantastic. I mean, I think it's really interesting as well, the relationship between, I suppose, humans and non-humans in this scenario, because obviously people are facilitating the care and the breeding of the animals. Are there particular design challenges in dealing with that? Like, what do you have to think about?
There's a sort of quarantining aspect of it. Like, you need an airlock in the frog facility, for example, and you've got noise issues as well. I mean, on both facilities for the frogs, the insulated panel was being used to try and create that thermal separation, but also acoustic separation. And then there were different set of challenges with the possum facility, but it's not dissimilar.
Hmm. Yeah, for me, I always had a mental model that you go to a zoo and you've got that exhibition type experience. Having worked on several of the projects, you start to shift your mindset, and it's less about putting the animals on display and more around creating their home and keeping the humans out of it and allowing them to go about doing their things, and then for the public to come and be a general observer or getting a sneak peek into the lives of these animals. It's a different design experience. And then from an engineering point of view, how do you design for these different creatures? It's kind of like you're getting back to the core of engineering. Humans have learned and evolved over centuries to be able to design things and engineer things. So there's a built-up embodied knowledge, and we've got that all codified now. And we've got the National Construction Code and Australian Standards, which define a lot how you design for humans.
But not really for animals.
Not really for animals, no. So when you come to designing something that's going to be interacted with an elephant, for example, what loads do you design it for? Or how robust does it need to be? How much deflection can you allow for? And that's really getting back to the core principle around doing just enough, but not overdoing it, because then it becomes too expensive or not viable. And doing that engineering piece, you've really got to rely on doing the study on what is possible on the loads and how does the animal or the environment interact with what it is we're designing.
So when you're thinking about designing for elephants then, what are the considerations, or transporting elephants? Like, what are the considerations and what do these transportation vehicles look like?
In this particular case, we are doing modified shipping containers because the zoo has a sponsor in Lindsay Fox, I believe, and they were donating the shipping containers and doing all the modifications to it. So we had a situation where the females in the herd in Melbourne Zoo all became pregnant. There was three babies, I believe, maybe four. And they've got an 18-month gestation period or something, and everyone from the zoo is going to be hearing this if they listen to it and probably correcting me on my assertions. However, I'm just an engineer, not a zoologist. So these elephants are having this really long pregnancy, and then that gave a timeline, a deadline to deliver these containers. So we're taking shipping containers and modifying them to be able to fit the mother and the calf in one container so that when they do get transported from Parkville to Werribee, they're comfortable in the mother and the calf are together to reduce the emotional stress on the calf. And to get them used to it, these devices needed to be installed in the zoo so that when the babies are born, they can interact with this container, or so to speak, this vessel for transport, be comfortable with that. And so they're getting the animal used to, or the elephant used to, being in and around this environment. So it's all very calm and stress-free when they do make the move. But when you've got this shipping container, so to speak, which is modified, it's got all doors taken off it and it's all open and airy, it's not like a clustered box, they can interact with it. It's formed part of the fence line to keep humans out, but also to protect the elephants from being able to roam around the rest of the park. They can bump into it, lean on it. Believe it or not, they can stand up on their hind legs and put their front legs up on parts of the crate. And that imposes different loads. How do you work out how much of the body weight of an elephant is on its front 2 feet? And
some very interesting centre of gravity questions there.
Yes.
Yeah, and we're also, I think, you know, as architects, we're used to designing, or we're used to thinking more about dead loads than quite dynamic live loads.
Mm.
A little bit about live loads, but these are very dynamic, I would imagine.
But I think what crosses both humans and non-humans is this idea of the body, right? I mean, in the human space, the traditional space, we've always been fascinated with how the body, human body, interacts with stuff, with doors, with windows, with tables, with chairs, with spaces more generally. That's our constraint. And the regulatory environment, the National Construction Code and the Australian Standard, is all really about the human body, the height of a balustrade, the height of a handrail, the width of a handrail. So when you apply all this logic to the non-human space, it's kind of the same in some ways. Like, dimensionally, you're dealing with a different animal. So elephants, obviously, as Peter's indicated, challenges because they're big, they're heavy, they're complex. And at the other end of the scale, you know, mountain pygmy possums, which we've had some experience with, which are actually the size of mice, you suddenly, you know, you're dealing with things that are very small, and so you're truly trying to prevent them from escaping. But you can also then transfer them between spaces, for example, in PVC tubes, you know, whereas to move us underneath one thing to another room is quite complicated. To move a mountain pygmy possum, you can do it on a 100 diameter tube. And which we did at the breeding facility for mountain pygmy possums. So they're running under little tunnels in between the sort of one type of facility, one type of room and another type of room, in little tunnels that you can lift up and inspect them moving around. But they have free movement, and then they can move outside, again, through these little miniature doorways, if you will, that are really just tubes. But then they're in enclosures, mesh enclosures, and we're having to do some pretty tight tolerances because these things, particularly when they're young, are very small. So, you know, buildings and facilities, particularly zoology facilities, you know, you've got to really tighten the envelope so things can't get out, and also importantly, the things can't get in. And that's the big challenge of something like Hills or Sanctuary, is keeping it fox-free. And so it's got a, you know, a big perimeter fence around it to prevent things from getting in, cats, foxes particularly.
So we've talked about things with four legs.
Mm.
How about raptors, Stuart?
Yeah, so the major project we've done at Hills or Sanctuary outside of the Frogs and Possums facility is a facility for raptors. It's the Raptor Rehabilitation Centre. And it's a direct extension programmatically and to some extent architecturally of the hospital facility they have there, the Wildlife Hospital, which is a project about 20 years old, which has been a great success and again proved instrumental in the bushfire catastrophe a few years ago. And what the zoo wanted to do there, what Hillsville Sanctuary wanted to do was they've got a bird program there. They treat and operate on birds. And so raptors are larger birds, larger native birds, so wedge-tailed eagles, pelican falcons, those sort of birds. And there's multiple species, and some of these are big. And the challenges with big birds, a bit like elephants, is normal things kind of don't work. So the briefing requirement for the raptor facility, which is essentially a flyway with a small building sort of component, internal component, is creating a flight tunnel condition that is orbital, that is a circular system. So traditional flight tunnels, and the sanctuary has one, are linear. They're like a corridor, and a bird flies down it and then flies back. The problem with dealing with large birds like raptors is they fly fast and they fly far. And so this facility is really about them regaining the ability to fly post-surgery. And the model that has been developed internationally, and there's a facility in Canada that we were looking at very closely, and the hills we were looking at, are really about an orbital facility. So it's like a loop. I sometimes describe it as a cross between an aviary and a particle accelerator. And these birds can fly well over 100 kilometres an hour at top speed. So stopping and starting these birds, particularly stopping them, can be quite tricky. And flying around, you want them to be able to fly at decent speeds and with a decent dimension. Wedge-tailed eagle can have a wingspan of 2 metres. So the brief really was to create, really with the money that the project had, as large a kind of cross-section as possible. In the end, that was 6 by 6 metres. And then for it to be a continuous tunnel. But not in a traditional aviary, where I think a lot of people think about enclosures in an aviary, which is a very light sort of mesh. The model developed overseas is that it's actually quite enclosing, particularly on the sides, so the sort of walls of it. So the system that, after a lot of testing, the system that was developed and built at Hillsville Sanctuary is a timber board system. So it's probably about 80% closed, but 20% open. The series of timber boards, spotted gum boards, with little 20-millimeter gaps in between them to allow air movement and some visible connection to the outside, but really to create a sense of enclosure and to remove distractions as these birds are recovering and beginning to learn to fly again. The top of it is quite open. That's more a combination of meshes and netting. And that's to prevent the birds obviously escaping, and that floods it with natural lots of light. So it's a very well lit environment, but importantly, particularly for Hillsville Sanctuary, it creates a low distraction environment for the birds to fly and learn to fly. And what's really important, interestingly, is it's not a circle; it's kind of a rounded rectangle, if you will. So that a straight is really important, because a straight section, a bit like on a Grand Prix straight, you have the straight. Is the ability then to look down the line and see how the bird's movement is post-surgery. If it's restored its ability to fly in a straight line, essentially, but also to be able to fly around in at high speed once it's going again. Perching requirements, so the birds can sit there. So you end up with a thing that's sort of very unique, and it's a donut effectively with a small building inside it that has a couple of courtyards and holding rooms and intensive care rooms and a sort of laboratory space. But essentially, it's a facility. It's almost like a very small building with a very large veranda. It's also how I describe it. And uniquely, I guess, what's innovative about the one at Hillsville Sanctuary is it's right on the threshold of that public end of the park and the back of house end of the park. So it's a very visible facility. It's next to the hospital. The public can see it. And there are some limited opportunities for the public to enter it. But there is a desire to try and let these birds get on with it. And so the real tension there was, how do you deal with acoustics again? Like, you've got these birds learning to fly again, and one side of the building is actually the sort of fence, if you will, to the public areas of the park. How do you deal with all those noisy children making, you know, a ruckus? And so there's actually a system of acoustic separation embedded in the walling system on that side to prevent too much noise transfer. So quite a complex set of constraints that are needed. And in the end, it sort of looks like a big timber cathedral, effectively. It's a sort of big timber thing. It's a steel structure. And then it's an exoskeleton. The structure's on the outside of the system, which is good. Engineers always like that. Architects like a bit of that too. You're sort of showing off your structure. And that's really – but that the idea there, or the requirement there, is the inside surface is as smooth as possible. So it reduces the amount of uncontrolled perching and obstructions that might hit birds as they're flying. So it's forced a really interesting architectural and structural solution. And then the role of the architect in this situation is just to sort of accept and try and take it in a particular direction that it wants to go, and as well as turn it into this very functional thing, this giant machine in some ways, but also an object that sort of works in the architectural context of the sanctuary, which is a really interesting architectural history with significant buildings in the recent past in it.
Mm. Yeah, Melbourne Zoo, I think, is quite known for, like, its interesting architectural projects, and Hillsville Sanctuary as well, which is fantastic.
Yeah, there's a Gregory Burgess building out there for the platypus. It's 30 years old this year, significant building, Minifee Nixon, did the hospital building that we worked adjacent to, and Cassandra Fay did a great little platypusery structure there a few years ago. So there's been a real history of innovation out there, and hopefully that continues.
Beautiful. I was wondering, Peter, if you could talk a little bit about some of the most interesting things or animals you've worked with at the zoo.
It's really interesting. Like humans, they all have their own personalities and different natures. So you take, for example, the gorillas. They'll quite happily climb up on playground-type structures and lounge around and do gorilla things and live their gorilla life. But if you take the orangutan, it's much more inquisitive and can be destructive. So the orangutans, if you put anything in their enclosure, you cannot have bolts because they'll run, go around, they'll find the bolts, then they'll use their hands and undo the bolts and can dismantle your structure. So we make sure in those environments that all the connections are welded so they can't come and take things apart. And just in terms of how inquisitive they are, I was told a story where somebody dropped a cigarette lighter into a orangutan enclosure. And the orangutan found the cigarette lighter, worked out how to use it, kept that to himself, and at night when the zoo was closed and everything else, he went to his bed, made of hay, used his cigarette lighter, lit his bed on fire, walked away and came back and then stamped it out. And they caught all of that on CCTV.
And luckily the orangutans were smart enough to pop it out as well.
Yeah, exactly.
Doesn't work now because they're all using vapes though.
Oh no, that's amazing. And when are the elephants getting moved?
I'm not sure on the exact date, but it's got to be probably later this year, I would expect, because the babies were due to be born late 2023. And then they become acclimatized, or maybe it's next year because they move them after a year or 2 years being in proximity to the crates. And then, off they go either later this year or next year off to Werribee where they've got a much bigger facility to go and enjoy and roam around.
Mm-hmm. And so the crates that are forming part of their fence at the moment will be the crates that are used to transport them?
Yes, so they're all there. They make it their little home.
Yeah.
And then when it comes moving day, they toddle off into their beds, so to speak, because that's where the babies have been sleeping. They go off into their shipping container, make their little bed, and then they close the door and secure the crates. And then we pick those up, crane them onto the back of a truck, and then the trucks drive down the street. So you might see a convoy of really strange looking shipping containers with trunks and elephant ears you can see in windows. That'll be happening sometime in the next 12 months. I'm not exactly sure when.
So you have to structurally certify the shipping containers?
We had to design it for loads.
Yeah.
And yes, we work with the zoo to agree and establish what the loads are that we're designing for.
Yeah.
And we're able to allow for certain amounts of deflection. So if an elephant kind of falls over or leans over, how much can that shipping container kind of move or rack? So we design for what we know as best. And then the other risks around that become identified and controlled in other means. So there's only, just like in all engineering and design elements, you identify the risks, you quantify the loads, and then for anything that you can't design for, you've got to mitigate out by control mechanisms.
Yeah, and it's probably worth sort of stating that the Partridge's ability to do that is actually not that common to think in first principles engineering. The structural engineering environment typically leads to conservatism because of an insurance environment that's quite aggressive and a structural compliance environment. So have engineers that are sort of lean into the challenges, particularly around zoology and art installation and temporary structures. You know, it's just so refreshing to see that kind of attitude because there are so many projects like that that traditionally probably got dealt with without design consultants, but, you know, do need them.
Yeah. If you think about, if you take the Olympic Games, opening ceremony, for example, you've got all of these really lightweight structures that need to interact with the public, are flown over the stadium. But what do you design that for in terms of a wind speed? It's up for an hour, and that's its design life. You can go to the Australian Standard and you can design it like a house for the 1 in 500 year wind, but that's going to lead to something that's not very aesthetically pleasing. It's heavy. It doesn't work. So you've got to think about, well, what's the probability of that wind occurring over that time frame? And you have an engagement with all the stakeholders and you do the analysis. You get the advice and you say, well, 90% of the days in this two-week period that the event is scheduled to do will not exceed this wind load. So that's our design criteria. Maybe it's 95%. And you come up with a risk-based approach. And it's the same with designing for elephants or anything in the public domain, or because how do you design for vandals? Or design a sculpture that's up
and
for a day.
How did that wind load stuff go for the Sydney Olympics?
For the Sydney Olympics, it did get quite down to the wire.
Didn't there involve an engineer standing there with a wind meter?
One of our partners was monitoring the wind speed on the site, and up until an hour before the ceremony, the wind speed was too high. And so you literally had an engineer sitting there in the opening ceremony control box making the call as to whether this piece would actually appear in the opening ceremony or not. Thankfully, it dropped an hour before showtime, and the whole show could go ahead.
And the winner was Sydney.
Unfortunately, in the Asian Games in Doha, a similar approach was taken, but they were not fully around the risk profile on the wind. And in that setting, a reasonable portion of the show could not go ahead because a shamal came up and the wind was too high, and unfortunately, there were a couple of pieces that were created and they had to pivot the show. But
there was still a show, but without some specific pieces.
Without some specific really lightweight pieces that were being flown in over the stadium.
That's fascinating, I think, to understand, like, if you bring everybody along board and understand, like, what the risks are and work within the parameters, how you can deliver different things that we don't expect can be delivered.
It's fascinating hearing about the difference between gorillas and orangutans. It reminded me when we were working on the project at MIT a few years ago, before we get into the zoology space, we were looking at a stainless steel mesh product, and a client was querying whether it would be strong enough to hold back, you know, university students. And we found some trade literature quite quickly that showed it being used for gorillas, and so we presented this to MIT and said, well, look, it can work with gorillas, so we assume there's an equivalency there with university-level students, and so it was on that basis that they were comfortable with using the system, because it was a product that had come out of zoology space, and then we were applying. Now you see that stuff quite commonly used as a restraint, balustrade system and screening systems, woven stainless steel mesh. It's actually very strong.
Mm. Do you have to be quite innovative in terms of materiality and bits and pieces like that in your work?
Some projects lend themselves to being innovative with materials and looking to do new ways with different things. Unfortunately, the regulatory environment sometimes makes that difficult depending on the application, because we need to know their strength and their capacity and make sure they're reliable so that we don't have failures. So if you're going to go and use a new product, you've got to be able to justify why it's going to give the reliability equivalent to something we know really well, like steel or concrete or timber. Something, I suppose, if you think about the cross-laminated timber products that have come onto the market, it's been around for quite some time. It's risen rapidly in popularity. And people were using that in construction of structures well before there was an Australian standard that dictated how it's to be used. And so if you're trying to do something that captures carbon or gets to a carbon neutral manner, you've sometimes got to go outside what the Australian standards currently provide for, but it doesn't mean that you do it recklessly. You've got to be able to justify it based on test data or calculations to be able to prove why you get a minimum level of reliability. Sometimes that innovation takes extra time and extra cost, so you've got to have the right client and the right project to be able to launch into that. But that's where the fun is.
Yeah, absolutely. And is there more space, I suppose, for that testing when you're doing something that you've not done before for, you know, animals? Is there more space for testing in that design realm?
Well, sometimes there's that a necessity because sometimes there's gaps in the regulatory environment and you do have to go on a more performance solution method and you need to work things out, again, first principles, but applied to materials. I mean, certainly when we were working on the zoology building at Little High School, there was a very close attention to materials and robustness. I think I toured every reptile house in the state, and the ones that had lasted and hadn't started falling apart were ones with robust materials, particularly in ceilings, because these environments often get high traffic areas if they're public exhibition areas, but they also often get humid. They're often not heated and cooled in the same way, and so you can often things start falling apart with traditional materials. So, and we had a tropical room, for example, in that building we did there. And so we needed a ceiling system that was going to handle humidity. And plasterboard just doesn't cut it. Plasterboard doesn't cut it almost in any application, really, but it's still the predominant internal lining used in Australia. But in these environments, so we were using brick because, we'd seen as an internal finish and an external finish because of its robustness, both thermally and in terms of traffic. And then for ceilings, we were using a product called Ripple Tone that's a sort of perforated corrugated steel finish that's often used in swimming pool applications. So you look at another typology where it has to deal with moisture and humidity, and we just appropriated there and went, well, if it works in a swimming pool, like it's going to work in this. And it has, and it has worked. It's a material ceiling system that will be there for the long term. Also, interestingly, on that zoology building at Little Isle High School, we also had to deal with two crocodiles. The school had one crocodile and acquired another. And part of the purpose-built facility we were doing there was to house those in a croc tank that was sort of brought into the project after we'd started designing it. And that was a unique challenge too, because they're not small.
And how large is a crocodile?
A couple of metres long. And so we had two of those. We had a whole space set aside for those. It was a tank. It was like an internal pool, really. It was built like a pool, had special membraning. But because of the exhibition element to that, the school had already acquired actually a 100 mil thick piece of acrylic that we then had to get checked in structurally that it could hold back water. Water's heavy. and then you've got crocodiles up against it as well. So, and that becomes the kind of viewing plane. So often when we go to a zoo type context and we see what we see is glass, it's often not, it's often acrylic, and it's often really thick because it's dealing with a lot. And so as a material, that was probably the most expensive per square meter material in the project, was something you don't see.
That reminds me of one we did for the TV show I'm a Celebrity, Get Me Out of Here.
Tell me more.
We did a glass coffin that was going to submerge Jason Donovan, I believe. And
instead, permanently or?
Just temporarily for the show and for the putting him out of his comfort zone. And we did that in perspex to make it lighter and
but then had the earth around it. You got buried.
He didn't get buried. He was going underwater, I believe.
Right.
And the camera needed to be able to capture his facial expression. And the thing with designing for perspex and acrylic is it's not like glass where it fractures. Mm. But as it flexes, it creates these little micro cracks.
Mm.
And then it goes white and a bit cloudy and a bit hard to see. So the whole design criteria for that was to make sure that you can see Jason Donovan's face when we put him in a submerged underwater coffin. Make sure that the perspex doesn't go cloudy as it gets loaded up.
Is that one of those moments where you go, how did we end up working on this?
Sometimes you pinch yourself and you say, how can I be so lucky?
Oh, that's amazing.
wanted to say a couple of things around the differences between working with humans and non-humans, and whether how much of that applies in the non-human space. So, you know, if you're dealing with animals of some kind, non-humans, you know, do the principles apply of things like outlook and amenity, access to natural light and ventilation, the things that, you know, if you're doing housing, and those of us who work in housing, these are essential, right? Being able to see a landscape and gardens, and to get cross ventilation, decent ceiling heights, warm, comforting materials. When we're working with animals, this is an open question, do these things apply as well? I mean, often it's around simulating a natural environment. And there's a long tradition in zoology of kind of the simulated natural scene sometimes involves painting it and creating, you know, enclosures. But does that work? Is you know, would the best environment be one where it's always outside, or interior environments like when we put a human inside? What makes us not go crazy? Is it the ability to know that we can always see the outside? So these are open questions that I think the non-human space is an emerging area of new interest begins to tackle with, I think.
Mm. And this idea, I suppose, of care, like how do we care across human and non-human ecologies?
Yeah, I mean, we've been interested in animal welfare as a concept for a long time, but what are the spatial architectural implications of that? I think that's still, it's an interesting area.
Peter, in the work you do, do you have any kind of thoughts on the human, non-human, what does it teach us about design?
That's a very interesting question. And there's a lot of emotional stuff in there, which being an engineer, I quite regularly get the option to not engage in. the difference or working on those two spaces kind of causes you to sit back, and Stuart alluded to it earlier around thinking around the humans and what we want to do and how we interact and experience the world, to what does an animal want? What's the nature of this being, and how do we facilitate what its natural or desire might be? And sometimes that might be to be able to shelter away and hide and get to a cold, dark place and curl up into a little ball and feel comfortable. Maybe other times it's, I want to be able to get out and run around and roam in freedom. I believe there's certain types of eucalyptus trees and leaves that some koalas will eat and not others. They'll turn their nose up at that kind of thing, and maybe that's something like a human being presented with a lovely meal. I don't know, maybe if you're a carnivore, a lovely steak versus a Big Mac. No offence to McDonald's, but being able to interpret what those needs are, which might change from season to season or from mood to mood or their emotional state. Does a pregnant animal have a different response to a male of the same species? I have absolutely no idea, but it's interesting to think about those things in our design. And as engineers, a structure engineer can all be too easy to rely on putting structure in the most efficient way possible. We say, no, there's got to be a column there, or that should have a wall. And engineers might put pressure on an architect to change the way they do their design without thinking, well, if I change my approach to the structure and I can get more light into this space by creating an opportunity for a bigger window, or not putting a column here to allow for the flow from one space to another and facilitate how humans experience and walk through that space or connect or create spaces that connect to each other, which is the magic of architecture that, as an engineer, I don't understand. But I don't want to mess with it. I want to find ways to be able to support that.
Yeah, I think that's what I was sort of getting at before. Like, you know, when we're working on this sort of joint use human non-human facility at the high school, it was kind of, well, we still need windows in this thing for the humans, but we kind of need windows in here for the animals too, right? Like, they're not so different. And I think one of the things in the non-human space that's really interesting is And you hear about this sort of on the news that, you know, as we look more closely at these things, it turns out that the sort of complex cultural, behavioural conditions are a lot closer to us than maybe we initially thought. There's been a very convenient sort of idea about us and them, and it turns out they might be just as complex a beast as we are.
Well, I think we've come to the end of our conversation for today. Thank you, Peter and Stuart, for joining us to speak about critters as catalysts. It's been a real pleasure to have you both.
Thank you.
Thank you. It's been really fun.
Thank you for listening to the Open House Melbourne Catalyst podcast. Open House Melbourne delivers Australia's largest architecture and built environment festival and year-round programming that connects people to place and builds public understanding of good design, inspiring people to explore, celebrate and care for their cities, suburbs and regions. Open House Melbourne's Catalyst podcast series was made possible with support from the Alastair Swain Foundation. Find out more at alastairswainfoundation.org. This series is recorded at The Push in Collingwood Yards, a youth music organisation and charity with the purpose of giving every young person the opportunity to participate and thrive in Australian music. Find out more about The Push at thepush.com.au.